We have seen how the work of the Lord Jesus Christ is anticipated in the calling of Adam, and how Christ is the second Adam who opens for us at the very gates of life that had been closed through Adam's sin. And we have seen that Abraham also, called of God to leave his country and go into a land that he did not know. We've seen that Abraham tested and tried with respect to the birth of his son Isaac, and then also with respect to the offering of Isaac as an offering of consecration to the Lord. We've seen that in this also, Jesus Christ is anticipated, as Jesus himself said, "Abraham rejoiced to see my day and saw it and was glad." Now this evening, I want to reflect with you on some of the experience of Jacob, the son of Isaac, and the way in which Jacob also prepares us for the coming of Jesus Christ, our Savior. In the passage that was read, you find Jacob journeying, leaving the very southern end of the land of the promise in Bathsheba, and going up to the north, and then swinging over to the east to go to Haran. And there he is going to stay with his uncle, Laban, the brother of his mother, Rebekah. Jacob is a wanderer. There's a book that's written by a French Christian philosopher who died quite recently, John Brown. Of course, in France, it's Jean Brun, but John Brown communicates a little better, I guess. He's written a book called The Vagabonds of the Occident. It's a fascinating book, as really all his books are. And in that book, he talks about the restlessness of modern man, how man is always journeying. Westerners are always journeying. He goes back all the way to the time of Alexander the Great, you know, who wept because he had no more worlds to conquer. Journeying, seeking new empires to meet, new armies to defeat. And then during the Middle Ages, pilgrimage was a regular occupation of many religious people, going to places where there were relics kept. And then, of course, that all led into the Crusades, when time after time, vast armies were assembled to seek to recover the Holy Land as the objective of their religious quest. And then following that, all the voyages of discovery. And then the claiming of the New World and the pioneers going westward. And we're still at it, you know. We still think of the real pioneering going on into space in man's flight and the whole concept of space exploration. In a way, Brun contrasts all that happens in the West with the East. He says if Western man is a vagabond, a wanderer, always searching, always reaching, well, then in the East it's quite different. The image of the Buddha is not the image of a wanderer. And he contrasts the posture of the Buddha with the myth of Tantalus, from which we get our word tantalize, you know, for his punishment for his various crimes were that he was put in a fiery place with wonderful fruit just above his head. Beautiful fruit, luscious, dripping with juice, but unattainable, and every time he reached for it, it would just lift that much above his reach. And Brun saw in that just an image of Western society, Western culture, always reaching for the unattainable, never satisfied, never at rest, always seeking, but never finding. The theme of pilgrimage, however, appears in the Bible in a different way, not as aimless wandering, but as the quest for that which God has promised. Walking in the way of the Lord, walking toward the goal of the Lord Himself. And the way passes through difficulty, through temptation, through trials, through suffering, through episodes of grief. And, Jacob now had experienced, certainly, his problems. And Jacob was a problem, too. He was a twin, you know. And his brother, who was very hirsute and was red, I guess he had red hair, and was a hunter in his later years. He was born first, but when Jacob was born as the twin, he was holding on to his brother's heel as he emerged from the womb. And that gave him his name, that he was a deceiver. To grab someone by the heel is to trick them, it's to blindside them, it's to clip them, to use football terms. You grab them by the heel, you see. So he was a cheater. And he was given that name, really, Jacob, which means basically a deceiver. And he showed that in his later life, because you will recall there were two times in particular when he cheated his brother Esau. The first time was when Esau came in from hunting, which he much liked to do, and he was exhausted and tired and hungry from the hunt. And Jacob didn't do much hunting. He was in the tents, it said. I don't know what he was doing in the tents, but he certainly wasn't out hunting. And this particular day, he was cooking. And he had made a wonderful stew with lentils. And I don't know what else he had in it, but it was reddish in color. And so when Esau came in so hungry from the hunt, he said, "Give me some of that red stuff. I'd like it." The play on the word red runs all along in connection, because the descendants of Esau are called Edom. Edomites, that means red. So here is Esau seeing this nice red stew that he'd like to get to eat immediately. And Jacob says, wait a minute, my stew. You hunt, I cook, but this is my dish. And if you want some of this, you've got to give me something. Well, what do you want? Well, I want the birthright. You're the firstborn. I want to have the place of the firstborn in the family, the place of honor, the place of the one who would get the double, the father's inheritance, really. The one who would succeed to the father in carrying on the family line. Jacob says, "Give me that, and you can have this bowl." And Esau said, "Well, when I die of hunger, the birthright won't do me any good. Give me the bowl." And so Jacob gave it to him. And we're told in the narrative, so did Esau despise his birthright. For you see, in this case, the birthright was not simply a place of prominence in the family, not simply being an heir to some possessions, because the patriarch still had no land in the promised land, or except the place where Abraham buried his wife. But there wasn't any land of possession that would go into the hands of Jacob. What did he want then? Well, you see, he wanted the promise. He wanted to be in the line of the promise. He wanted to carry forward that great promise that had been made to Abraham, that in him all the families of the earth would be blessed. And then as Isaac grew old and was blind in his later years, he called his son Esau to him. Many of you know the story. And he said, "Son, please go hunting for me this time and get a good kill of some young animals, young deer perhaps, and bring it back and prepare me the food I like so much to eat. And after we've had a good dinner together from your hunting, then I want to give you the blessing, my blessing, before I die." And Esau was happy to hear that, so he went out to his favorite sport, hunting. But Rebekah had heard what was said, their mother. And Rebekah favored Jacob over Esau, and so she told him to get at this business of deceiving. The time was ripe for it. She said, "Kill a couple of lambs out of the flock, and I'll prepare them, and I'll put in all the seasoning that your father likes, and cook it all up, and you serve him that meal. You pretend to be Esau, and you get the blessing." And Jacob said, "Well, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because my father may be blind, but he'll certainly recognize me." And great problem was that Esau was so hairy that it was the only necessary to touch his arm to tell it was Jacob and not Esau. So they fixed that up too with some skin that was fastened around Jacob's arms, and even put on his chest a bit to, under his garments. But the extra touch was that he was dressed in Esau's clothes. Esau was a hunter. He hung his best clothes somewhere in the tent where they were, and of course his mother had access to them, so she dressed up Jacob in Esau's clothes. And Esau went in, and he pulled it all off. He came to his father, and of course his father was suspicious, and asked, "Are you really my son Esau?" And Jacob lied outright, "Yes, I am, father. I'm your son Esau, no doubt about it." He says, it seems funny, your voice is the voice of Jacob, but come here, come close to me." So he comes close. His blind father feels him. "Well, yeah, all right. your arms are the arms of Esau, all right." But he was still a little bit suspicious. But it was the clothing that did it, you see, because apparently even Esau's best clothes had the smell of the field on them. And his father was impressed with that, and he said, "Well, it must be Esau, all right." And that got him started on his blessing. Beautiful blessing. "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of heaven's dew and of earth's richness and abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you." The sons of your mother bow down to you. "May those who curse you be cursed, and may those who bless you be blessed." That's the blessing that was given to Jacob. Well, you know the story, I'm sure. Esau came in after Jacob had left with the blessing. And Esau prepared his venison to give to his father. And he says, his father Isaac asked him when he came in, "Who are you?" "I am your son," he answered, "your firstborn, Esau." Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came, and I blessed him, and indeed, he will be blessed." When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob, deceiver? He has deceived me these two times. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." Then he asked, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau, "I've made him lord over you, and have made all his relatives his servants, and I've sustained him with grain and new wine. So what can I possibly do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father." Then Esau wept aloud. His father answered him, "Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven above. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke from off your neck." That was the best blessing that he could give to Esau. Well, I stopped to review that story with you because all this is in Jacob's mind as he starts off on this journey. The journey to his uncle's house in this very distant place. He's thinking about it, of course, because his reason for leaving was twofold. First, that he might find a wife among his mother's people and not marry a heathen woman, as his brother Esau had done. Esau had married two Hittite women, and his mother and father were very displeased by that. So Jacob goes to Haran to get a wife from his mother's folk. But the other reason is that Esau has said, "As soon as my father is dead, I will kill my brother." And Jacob has reason to fear Esau's rage. And Jacob leaves home. It took him about 3 days of walking to get to the place where the narrative that you heard read occurred. A wanderer, leaving home, concerned where even his food and clothing is going to come from. I don't know if you noticed at the end when Jacob speaks, he says, "Lord, if you give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house." He didn't have a big suitcase with him, you understand. It's a long trip. Where is he going to get food? Where is he going to get clothing? And he's alone. And alone, realizing that he's deceived his father, alone, realizing that he's a wanderer and doesn't know the future. And so we're told in this setting that he comes to a place when the sun's going down, a high place up in the hills, and there he prepares to sleep for the night. He takes a stone and uses it for his pillow. You may think your pillow isn't ideal at the camp, but believe me, it's better than a stone. But people used to sleep on things hard in those days. In Egyptian tombs, you see what they slept on. Wooden arrangements with a little hollow to them. So anything that had a little hollow would serve. I suppose it's all in the technique of how you get used to sleeping, but they did sleep on hard things that had little hollows where their head would sit. So he found a stone that he could sleep against and put his head on, and composing himself with his robes, he went to sleep. And then he had this dream that was given him by the Lord. And just two things I want you to think about with regard to his dream. First of all, the stare of God that appears in the dream, and secondly, the house of God, which is symbolized by the dream. The stare of God is the way in which we are shown that God intervenes in the life of Jacob. God intervenes to repeat the promise that he's made to Abraham and to Isaac, repeating it now to Jacob. And God intervenes by coming to him in the dream. You know, the whole Bible shows us that God takes the initiative in salvation. Jacob is not on his quest seeking the Lord. Jacob hasn't done very well at seeking the Lord in his whole life, has he? curious thing. He wants the right things, but he tries to get the right things in the wrong way. His desire is for the blessing. He just desires it more than life itself, and yet he deceives and lies to get the blessing. So he's not a searcher for God. He wants the blessing, but not on God's own terms. And it's God who calls to him. It's God who gives him the dream. God called Adam and Eve in the garden, didn't he? God addressed Noah and told him to build the house. God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. And as Paul reminds us in the 9th chapter of the book of Romans, Jacob was chosen of God even from the very beginning. While they were still in the womb and before they had done anything good or evil, Paul says, it is said of them, the elder shall serve the younger. Jacob was already chosen in the words spoken to his mother. Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. God had chosen Jacob, and God chooses to intervene in Jacob's life and to reveal himself to Jacob. And God comes in a way that is very effective. He gives Jacob this dream of a great stairway. Now, I know the song is We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder, and we didn't sing it by special request. but it's the wrong idea, unfortunately. It's you know, it's a nice song. I like the song, but I used to prepare Vacation Bible School materials and do artwork for them, that sort of thing, and I had the task of doing some handwork stuff, you know, that involved this story, and so I drew Jacob down at the bottom asleep. I put a robe over him to make it easier to get all the anatomy right under a robe. But here he is sleeping, and then here goes the ladder, right from where he's speaking, right up into some clouds. Well, even for Sunday school art, it looks a little implausible, you know? I mean, a ladder. I had it like a painter's ladder, you understand? Like a big extension ladder, and it's resting on the clouds up there. And it didn't look very good, but I had more work to do, so it went to the press, you know, Jacob's ladder, traditional style. But that did get me to thinking. So I went back and looked at the word for ladder. This was after it was already printed, unfortunately. But I went back and looked at the word for ladder, and I found it's used of stairs. It's used of, the term is used for the side of roadways. It's not a painter's ladder. It's a stairway. And what kind of stairway is it? Well, a stairway that reaches all the way to heaven. And that got me to thinking, too, where else in the book of Genesis do you hear of anything going to heaven or anything being built up toward heaven? Where? Tower of Babel, exactly. And when this you get this echo, then you begin to think, oh, yes. What about this communication between earth and heaven? Here's this sinner on this hilltop in Bethel, but God communicates with him and shows him a stairway, you see. Well, men had tried to build a stairway to heaven. Now, if you're going to build a big stone stairway that will go very, very high, you can't build it on a slant, obviously, all right? I mean, you can't pile stones on a nice angle. You've got to buttress them, so you have to build something much more like a pyramid, right? In fact, what you have to build is something like a ziggurat. Now, you know what a ziggurat looks like. You've seen pictures of ziggurats. You probably don't have one in your room or anything like that. But a ziggurat looks like a birthday cake, a square birthday cake with layers. Now, most wedding cakes are round, but you could do differently and make yours square. But I mean, you're square anyway, right? So here you put the square wedding cake layer on layer on layer, right? And that's how you get it high enough, right? The ziggurats in Mesopotamia, one of them was called the head to heaven. It's remarkable that those ziggurats were carefully studied, and there was a French archaeologist, André Parot, who wrote extensively about the ziggurats, and I think very convincingly. He pointed out, for example, that they are spoken of as houses. They're all called houses, the house of the gods, you see, or the house of the meeting of heaven and earth. Terms like that are used just in the names of the ziggurats. And so, obviously, there was a temple at the top, and then another bigger temple at the bottom. You can't build a very big temple at the top of the ziggurat because you used all that stone to get it high enough. You're trying to get it up toward heaven, making it look like a mountain. And on the top, you put a temple. And that's the temple where the gods could touch down. It was sort of like a heliport. The god could come in and touch down at the top of the ziggurat. And then the ziggurat then had a huge stairway that just came all the way down the side of the ziggurat. That's what it was for this big stairway. So there'd be a little temple up like on a mountaintop, then this huge stairway coming all the way down, and the steps of the stairway, the archaeologist tells us, were too big for man. They were high steps, so human beings would have trouble walking up or down them because they were God-sized steps. So the god would land at the top, and then he could come down the stairway, and then at the bottom there was a bigger temple where he could be properly worshipped. So there was the idea. Now, in the story of the Tower of Babel, if we may suppose that tower may have resembled the later ziggurats, well then, and how else would you build the tower that high for the gods to come down? But you see, that's what they were doing. Building a place where God would come down. Where God would come down to their place, where they would set up the place, tell the god where to land, have all the arrangements, all the conveniences, and the god could come down exactly where they had planned. Well, God did come down, didn't he? You read the passage, but not exactly as they had figured. Because the Lord judged the building of the Tower of Babel. He judged it. The Tower of Babel did not look then like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the way it did in some of the Doré etchings. I don't know if you were raised on them. I was. I guess you weren't. But anyhow, it was like a ziggurat, and the top, you see, they said, we'll build the top up to heaven, the same language used in describing the ziggurat, we'll build the top up there, the place where you, God, come, you please come down, this is where you're to come down. But God came down in judgment and scattered them, because in building their city, and building this tower, the place where God would come down, a top which would go up to heaven itself, they were exalting in their human pride. They were telling God how he would be worshipped. They were setting out from their perspective to order God to conform to their plans and come to their place, and that their pride would be supreme over all, really. And God judged that and scattered them so there would not be one totalitarian, one world at that point under the control of those who were the rebels and haters of God. And so mankind was scattered at that time at the Tower of Babel. But now, Jacob sees another tower. Not constructed by man. constructed by God. And he sees angels ascending and descending on this tower. Amazing that God establishes his place. He reopens communication. And he does it with a man that is named the deceiver and has lived up to his name. But God still has a purpose of grace for that man. A purpose of grace that will involve great changes in Jacob himself. If you read the story, you find out how much Jacob has to change. But God has his purpose. And he reveals himself to Jacob as the God of Abraham, your father, and of Isaac. The God of the promise appears now to Jacob. And he's also the God of the future, because he promises to Jacob not only that he is the God of the fathers, but he's going to be the God, your God. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you're lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. What an amazing promise. The past, the God of the fathers, the future, he will give him the land, he will give him offspring, his descendants, he will give him his blessing, and the present. I will not leave you until I've done that which I have promised. The stairway of God. Well, notice in the morning Jacob's reaction. Well, even immediately when he has the dream, verse 16. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it." He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." And that when he dedicates the pillar in the morning, he calls the place Beth-El. And that means the house of God. So it's not only the stairway of God. It's not only the place where God opens communication. It's not only that God comes down to Jacob here has a stairway with angels ascending and descending. But it's more than that. It's the very presence of God. Not merely the intervention of God, but the very presence of God. It's made historical reality, you see. This land I will give you, God says. That's the promise Abraham repeated. He'll give him the land. Jacob had had quite a survey of the land for 3 days, hadn't he? Traveling all the way from Beersheba, all the way up to Bethel, which is not far north, but well to the north in the land. Slept on it. If you've tended any, and depends on how sophisticated you are, how comfortable you make yourself when you're out with a backpack tenting. But if you're not very sophisticated, it can be very uncomfortable just sleeping on the ground, you know, unless you're kind of used to that. I have the feeling that Jacob had a strong sense of the land by the time morning broke. But this land that was given to him, it was all his, you see. And when he gets up in the morning and he looks all around him, what does he say? Well, what would you expect Jacob to say? Well, wouldn't you expect him to say, this land. Here I am up on a mountain where Bethel is. And I can look all around. It's all mine. This land is given to me by the Lord, as it was given to my father and my grandfather. But see, that's not what he says. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Now, why does he think of this as the gate of heaven? Well, it gives us some clues on Jacob, of course. Jacob comes realizing that the God of his fathers is the God who made heaven and earth. And he realizes that he's the transcendent God. He realizes that he's the God of heaven. He realizes that the God of his fathers is not like the idols of the towns he's been passing through as he travels northward. He realizes he's worshiping the true God. But he realizes something else, friends. He realizes that that God who says, I will not leave you till I've done everything I've promised, he realizes that that God is present with him. Now, here's where a footnote in the NIV is the clue to the proper understanding of what happened. Because it's often translated, usually translated, the way the NIV translates it in the main text, where we read, he saw a stairway resting on the earth, and the NIV has it right, stairway, not ladder, resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. The angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And then verse 13, there above it stood the Lord. And he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and so on. But the term that is translated above it, that is above the ladder, God up in heaven at the top of the stairway, the term could also mean stood beside him. And the NIV gives that as a marginal reading. Well, that marginal reading is right. And the reason we know it's right is because you have the same preposition with the masculine pronoun, in Genesis 35, verse 13. When Jacob goes back to Bethel again, after God does bring him back and restore him, Jacob finds out that God has called him again, brought him back, and we're told that God spoke to him again at Bethel, verse 11, I am God Almighty, be fruitful, increase in number, a nation, a community of nations will come from you, and kings will come from your body. The land I gave Abraham and Isaac, I also give you. And I will give this land to your descendants after you. Then verse 13. Then God went up from upon him at the place where he had talked with him. And it's the same preposition there. Went up from upon him. Now, that preposition is used often of people who come to meet people. We talk about... Well, if you're lying down, somebody comes and stands over you, doesn't he? That expression, come upon someone, stand upon someone, stand over someone, it just means to come and encounter them, to come and stand beside them. But in Genesis 35, it's quite plain that that means God went up from upon Jacob. That is, he had come down. He was standing beside him. He went up from beside him. And so since it's the same preposition exactly, used in the same context exactly, with the same promises being given, it seems clear that we interpret the first in the light of the second. And it's perfectly clear in the second, there's no stairway for God to be in the top of. He's on top of Jacob. Jacob is, in the first case, lying down asleep. In the second case, probably prostrate in worship. But God comes and stands over him, you see. And then he went up from over him, went up from upon him. Now, I wanted to emphasize that little footnote, that translation, because it really makes a lot of difference. You see, God is not standing over the stairway up in heaven, calling down promises to Jacob. God comes down the stairway. That's what he does. He comes down and stands beside him. And that's why Jacob says, God was in this place and I didn't know it. He wasn't up there, he was down here. He came down to talk to me, to give me the promises. And he says, I will not leave you. You see, he's with Jacob. He's where Jacob is. And he says, I won't leave you until I've done everything that I've promised to you. Some difference in Jacob's wandering, right? The Lord is with him. And the Lord will stay with him. The Lord will bring him back to the land. The Lord will give him the promises. And the Lord will fulfill all the things that he has promised. Jacob's descendants will fill the earth. You know, there's one more time when the Tower of Babel comes into view in the Bible, and that's at Pentecost. Because the division of languages at Babel were all united at Pentecost. Because in the many languages of human beings, the Holy Spirit spoke through the apostles on Pentecost. And so here is Jacob being given that promise of being a blessing to all the nations, the promise that was fulfilled as the Spirit carried the word to the Gentiles in the book of Acts. God came down. Heaven was opened, and God came down. And Jacob said, "The Lord is in this place." And God would dwell with Jacob and not leave him until he had done everything he had promised. And so Jacob in the morning worships the Lord and gives his vow to the Lord of fidelity to God. Now, I know Jacob's promise has been made a little, too insecure. As though Jacob's still bargaining with God. "Lord, if you do all these things for me and I'm counting them off, then I'll worship you and I'll give you a tithe of what I possess." Well, I have to admit that it might not be beyond Jacob to bargain even with God. But I don't think he was bargaining at this point. I think he's just describing, "Lord, you do all these things that you've promised." See, he said, "I'm filled with awe. How dreadful is this place? This is the very house of God. This is the gate of heaven." And so he's overwhelmed with the reality of God's presence. He's saying, "Lord, you do all these things that you have promised. And, oh, Lord, you will be my God. I will worship you. And I will give you a tithe of all that I possess. I will regularly and faithfully serve you." Filled with adoration and awe, it is not in Jacob's mind so much what God will do for Jacob as what God will be for Jacob. And that is brought to a great climax later in a story that we don't have time to look at tonight. But I just want to mention it because you may be troubled about God dealing so graciously with this cheater who still needs a lot of work done in him. If he were in your small group, you'd really have to work him over, wouldn't you? Nobody works anybody over. It's just sharing to help one another. I wanted to make that point clear. But here is Jacob. I have to mention it. He does go, you know, to his uncle's place. He went away, he says, with his staff and nothing else. But he came back, two companies of people, his two wives with their servants and livestock enough to start any number of ranches. He peels off a whole ranch of cattle, goats, sheep. All breeding stock that would start a whole ranch. He peels all of that off and sends it ahead because he hears, as he's coming back to the land in faithfulness to God's command, he hears that Esau is coming to meet him. His brother Esau coming to meet him. And he's not sure it's exactly a welcome because he's been uncomfortable about coming back where Esau is. And Esau's coming to meet him with 400 men. And that doesn't just exactly sound like welcoming day when you come to Cedar Campus, does it? I mean, 400 men coming to meet him. And Jacob has to quick make some arrangements, which he does. He puts his people across the Jabbok River. It runs from east to west. And I judge he put them across on the north side of the Jabbok. And he remained on the south side of the Jabbok, nearer to where Esau's coming. Esau's coming from the south. So he puts the two companies over for safety, and then he's alone. And alone he prays. And when he prays, you see what spiritual progress he's made. We don't have time to look at it tonight, but take a look at Jacob's prayer. It's a beautiful prayer, beautiful prayer. And then that man comes alone to wrestle with Jacob. And Jacob has this encounter with the angel. He wrestles with the angel. through the night. And beautiful story. And later it says that Jacob has wrestled with God and prevailed. And his name is changed to Israel, a prince with God, because he has prevailed in his wrestling with God. But a marvelous story, because the amazing thing is the angel, in order to win in that battle, has to lose. Because what does Jacob want? Same thing, the blessing. But more intimately, he wants to know the angel's name. He wants to know the Lord. And he realizes that he cannot let go, because he must have what only the Lord can give him. And so he hangs on in the sheer desperation of a true faith. And you see, if the angel wins the wrestling match and Jacob loses, then Jacob doesn't get his request, does he? But the angel's wrestling with him precisely to give him the request. So the angel has to lose to win, and does, for the angel grants Jacob's request and gives him the blessing. And Jacob, too, has to lose to win. You see, he can't beat God. And the angel shows his power. He just touches Jacob's hip, and Jacob is lame. You know, you can't wrestle with a dislocated hip. And Jacob realizes there's no winning for him. But Jacob can only do one thing, and that's hang on. And hang on he does. And then the angel says, let me go, because the day is breaking. Some of the liberal scholars think that that angel was a kind of night spirit, and it would be dissolved by the rising sun. And therefore, sort of like Cinderella in angeldom or something. If the sun came up, angels evaporate. Don't know where they got that idea, but anyway, it isn't the threat to the angel. No, it's the threat to Jacob. Why a threat to Jacob? Because with the rising beams of the sun, he would see the face of God. See, he asked for his name, and he was told that the name was Wonderful. It's the very name of the Lord. And Jacob receives the blessing. Well, I had to mention that because I had to show you that God doesn't let Jacob get away with all of this. God does purge him, that God does purify him. In short, God does save him. And friends, all of this that I've been telling you about Jacob, you see, it's built into the story of Jesus. It's preparing for the coming of Christ. It's the line of the promise. This is the line that leads to the birth of Jesus Christ. And just to show you that Jesus thought that way, I would remind you of that little passage in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, when Nathanael is brought to Jesus. Jesus finds Philip, John 1, verse 43. Jesus finds Philip and says, follow me. And Philip does. And then Philip finds Nathanael and says, we have found him of whom the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael says, Nazareth, can any good thing come from there? And Philip says, come and see. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching him, he said of him, here is a true Israelite in whom there is, well, it's translated here, nothing false. It should be right out, in whom there is no deceit. That's what the word means, dolos. It means deceit. And the point is, it's referring to Jacob. Here is a true Israelite, see, a true son of Israel, a true son of Jacob, but an Israelite. And not a Jacob anymore, but an Israel, one in whom there is no guile, one who's not a trickster as Jacob was, but is sanctified as Jacob became. Here is a true one in the line of the people of God. And so Jesus knows Nathanael and says, here is a true Israelite in whom there is no guile, unlike Jacob. And then Nathanael says, how do you know me? And Jesus answered, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. Then Nathanael declared, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Because he saw him under a fig tree. Yesterday, I saw you under a cedar tree. So what else is new? What gave him that reaction? You see the point, don't you? Something very unusual must have been going on under that fig tree. It must have been a time when Nathanael was meeting with God, you know. Must have been. And Jesus says, I saw you then. And Nathanael says, you know that? I saw you during the Sunday afternoon of silence on that rock or under that tree at that time when you were dealing with your Lord. I saw you then. And Nathanael said, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus said, you believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You shall see greater things than that. He then added, I tell you the truth. You shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on Jacob. Right? Ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Jesus says, yes, they ascended and descended at that spot that was Bethel, the house of God, the gate of heaven. They ascended and descended on that stairway that God opened from heaven to earth. And they came down to the one Jacob who became Israel. But it isn't Jacob. It isn't Israel who is the Savior of the world. Jesus says, I am. And you will see the angels ascending and descending as you see me in my glory coming again to this world. Friends, as you reflect on that, remember, Jesus Christ is the one who descends and ascends, and he is the one upon whom the angels ascend and descend, and he's the one who has come down in order that he might be lifted up. And remember John 3. He's the one, nobody ascends but the one that descended, but he's going to be lifted up. And lifted up how? Lifted up as the serpent in the wilderness. Lifted up to pay the price of sin. Lifted up on the cross of Calvary. I will never leave you, God told Jacob, until I've done everything that I've promised. Never leave. And he never did. He stayed with that line of the promise through all the sin, through all the evil. He stayed and stayed and stayed. And then at last, he came. Jesus Christ. There is communication between heaven and earth. Not just, certainly not at the Tower of Babel. And not just in a dream that Jacob had. But there is communication in the God-man, Jesus Christ. He is the true Jacob. Indeed, more than that, he is the Lord. He is the Lord who came down the stairway. He is the Lord who wrestled with Jacob and lost that Jacob might win. He's the one who came and paid the price in order that through him we might have eternal life. Friends, the point of all this is that promise to Jacob is true for you. It is. God says, I will never leave. I'll never leave until I've done everything that I've promised. Everything. And what he's promised is to make you like his beloved son. C.S. Lewis says, if we could ever see your neighbor the way he'll look in that day, then you'll be strongly tempted to fall down and worship that woman or that man. I'll never leave till I've done everything that I've done. Jesus Christ is here in this place with you. He's meeting with you. And there's no loneliness, there's no despair in his presence. Jacob anointed a pillar as a marker of that place. Here in this very spot, God came down and spoke to me. Well, friends, we don't anoint even your favorite rock. No. We anoint the Lord's anointed. We anoint Jesus Christ with the perfume of our devotion. We come to him. And the marker he's given us is in his suffering, his body, and his blood. I will never leave until I've done everything that I have promised. Do you believe that? Lay hold of that promise of God and understand what it was that Jesus said to the disciples. For that day is coming when you will see heaven open and the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man.